Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Parsha class. Parsha Shmos. We begin the new book, the book of Shmos, and it is 5772. And this year we are focusing on excerpts from different commentaries. I try to select something, a random author, which ties in somehow to the Parsha, but sometimes not that much. Let me also preface today's lesson by noting that last week our discovery, if you will, was about the important theme of chitzonius and pnimius, which means externality and internality, as it relates to the way we study Torah and the way we view the world and the way we live ourselves as people. I think this is a major one. Sometimes, every now and then, I discover something which I say to you, this is really a very, very important principle. Well, I think this is one of them. And because of what we started with last week, I feel okay presenting to you something which is not a classic Torah commentary, nor a classic Torah commentator. It's somebody who's contemporary. She's living. It's a her. She's a psychologist, but she's a religious Torah psychologist. Her name is Miriam Adahan. She has written many books. Some of them are on our shelves. She spoke in Atlanta some many years ago, and she said something there that blew me away. And I always thought about it. And when I was thinking about what to present to you today, given our introduction of last week, I said, this is what we're going to study. So I'm going to pass out to you something, an excerpt from an online essay taken from one of her books by Dr. Miriam Adahan. Okay, let's keep one. And since we only present a one-sided page at our classes, I have an extra notes which didn't fit on the first page, but that's extra. It's not official. Okay, Shlomo needs a page two if you don't mind. Now, again, the concept of external and internal relates on several different planes, and I once again feel strongly, and I have to keep thinking about this because this is just an idea that's been recently germinating, but I think that our ability to study Torah, to study the internal meaning of the Torah, and our ability to internalize what we know and what we understand are related. Internalizing what we know is a process which, as we learned last week from Rav Dessler, requires that we take our information and we bring it from the intellect into our emotions and ultimately into our bodies, into action. And I believe that the more we can internalize, the more we can emotionalize, so to speak, our intellect, the more we are able to see those internal and hidden meanings in the Torah. In other words, Rav Dessler taught us that the Torah is a body of knowledge from another world. It's not from here. It's not from this world. And the only way we can bring it into this world is because God gave us this tool called our intellect. And our intellect is a tool that can access otherworldly information on a strictly intellectual basis, not bringing it home into the inner recesses of our existence in this world. So that's a good, but it's a problem also. It's good because it gives us access to vast storehouses of godly wisdom, but it's not good because it's just sitting there in our intellect. And that's not good. That's not going to help us in this world. For that, we need the process of internalizing. So our ability to do that is very much related, I believe, in our ability to become more emotional about what it is we are, what it is we know. I can't exactly explain how those two are interconnected, but I feel they are. So hopefully as this process continues, we will get more and more clear. So what we're going to do today, this essay, I think, has the power to do both for us. On one hand, we are going to take a breathtaking view that Miriam Adahan has of what does it mean to live in Egypt, the story of the exile in Egypt. What does that mean on an internal human level, not on a historical level? And what does it mean to come out of exile, to experience the exodus on a very human internal level? And if we can get her grasp of this internal level of the Torah, we are going to be shocked as into the implication that it has about how we view ourselves. Okay, enough fluff. Let's read. The pasuk that we are going to be referencing as our parsha connection is chapter 5, pasuk 9. The work shall be made harder for the men so that they shall be busy doing it and not talk about trivialities. This is Pharaoh's words to his henchmen, his taskmasters, to make the task even harder so that they will not talk and ask for silly things like, can we go out of Egypt for 3 days and worship God and then come back, etc. Pharaoh says they're just talking too much. They have too much time on their hands. Now that's external. He's afraid that the Jewish people are going to plot and get up and leave. Mesilas Yesharim, The Path of the Just by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, an old friend of ours, sees in this verse his internal message, which is that Pharaoh is concerned not simply about a practical matter, but he's concerned about the spiritual state of the Jews. To quote Rabbi Luzzatto, his intent was not only to deny them any respite from their work, to take note of their plight, or to plot against him, but also to prevent them from any reflection, by means of ceaseless toil. Pharaoh, he had a very great understanding of spirituality. He knew, and again, this is internal Torah, he knew that if the Jews would be spiritual, he could not contain them. He could not dominate them. He knew that what allows a person to begin the path of spirituality is having time to reflect. And that the greatest enemy to that is keeping busy. And so he said, if they are asking to go serve God, it's only because they're reflecting on the meaning of life. And that's what they're looking for. They have too much time on their hands. I've got to keep them from reflecting on spirituality. And therefore, I must increase the workload. This is just an example of how Rabbi Luzzatto sees in the, last week we quoted Rambam. Rambam says that if the Torah has an allegory, you have to take the allegory and the literal, and then you have to look behind it. Well, on a certain sense, everything in the Torah is allegorical, even if it's a story, even if it's a true account, but it's allegorical in terms of what it has to teach us. So, we could look at the story of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, and just think it's a story of kings and slave workers and who are building cities. But Rabbi Luzzatto is shining the internal light of Torah and saying it's about spirituality. So, anyway, I think that that gives us just a permission or precedence for seeing the experience of the servitude in Egypt as something spiritual. This is going to be the starting point of Dr. Adahan's analysis. Okay, so we're quoting the Masilta Sharm just by way of demonstrating a deeper internal look at the Torah, and now we're going to listen to Dr. Adahan's words. The article that's on it's online under the name "Leaving Egypt" by Miriam Adahan. It's really reprinted from one of her books, "Living with Difficult People, Including Yourself." And I, just for our sake of orientation, in case we've never heard of her, on her website, this is a little paragraph with which she introduces herself. This is Dr. Miriam Adahan, and I am an expert in the field of Jewish Torah psychology. It's a nice field. I am here to help you learn the coping skills needed to turn life's difficulties into opportunities for spiritual advancement. We live in extremely troubled times, with existential threats to the existence of the entire world hanging over our heads, as well as all the irritations, disappointments, and annoyances of life which need to be confronted on a daily basis. She's a psychologist, but she's a Torah psychologist, which means she is a Jewish practicing woman. She sees, she knows that the Torah is the blueprint for life, and that everything that is true in the psychological world is somehow sourced in the Torah. And there are others like Rabbi Dr. Tversky, Dr. Fisher. It is a wonderful combination. There's other ones, Dr. Wickler, Dr. Pliskin. There are some great, great people who combine Torah and psychology. Again, not everything that they write is necessarily based on the teachings of the oral tradition. But I wouldn't necessarily do this on a regular basis. But I think that it's so compelling, and especially since we do need to look at Torah more internally. Okay, here we go. She cites the Talmud. Each and every day, every person is obligated to see himself as having personally left Egypt. Now that's right out of the Talmud. That's not written by a psychologist. That's Talmudic. The question is, how does one see oneself as leaving Egypt? We don't live in Egypt. We've never visited Egypt. It's certainly not something that happens on a daily basis. It happened 3,000 years ago. What does the Talmud mean? Egypt in Hebrew, Mitzrayim, literally means a place of narrowness. A Mitzar is a border. Like a country has, Mitzarim has borders on this side and that side. And it Mitzar, Tsar really means narrow borders. The word Tsaros, by the way, comes from that narrowness. Suffering, Tsaros. So Mitzrayim literally means a place of narrowness. It was a place where people were enthralled by flashy materialism, were fascinated with death, and were lacking in reverence for life. It was a society which believed that only those people in the most exalted positions were deserving of honor. and that they were justified in their arrogant disregard of and cruelty toward those who were beneath them. It was a place in which we lived in physical slavery and bondage. Interesting. So what she's saying is that the reason why a king could create slaves is because that was really just an extension of the mentality of the whole society. It's just it was more extreme. Everyone, in some degree, is a slave to the king. So the Jews will just become more severe slaves. But really, this was a mentality that pervaded the whole country. Now, within each of us, there is also a spiritual Mitzrayim from which we must extricate ourselves daily. This coming out of Mitzrayim is accomplished by breaking out of our narrow boundaries and demonstrating our reverence for God, for the godliness within man, and for the lasting values of Torah. Because reverence for God, reverence for the godliness of man, and values of Torah are not narrow, and they don't create narrowness. As we will see, this is a difficult transition. Our Mitzrayim begins during childhood, in which our view of life is distorted by the limitations of our mental capabilities. In other words, we don't understand things when we're young. For example, young children often perceive love in terms of how much they get, both emotionally and materially. I didn't get a birthday present. That means my parents don't love me. That's a distortion of truth, but that's their perception. In reality, mature love is based on a desire to give, not receive, as hinted at in the Hebrew word for love, ahava, whose root means give. Children also misunderstand the meaning of power. They think it means simply having control over others, not realizing that true power is the ability to master and control our own impulses. Like the sages say in Pirkei Avos, who is strong? He who controls his impulses. Because children are dependent on others for their sense of worth and security, they try to control the people and events around them. Yet they often feel deprived and afraid since they are dependent on people whom they cannot really control. They often blame others, usually their parents, for their unhappiness, try to coerce them into giving them what they want by acting mad, sad, bad, sick, or crazy. They scream, cry, beg, criticize, cling, sulk, act helpless, withdraw, complain, overfunction or underfunction. Do you think she's a mother? Overfunction, underfunction, use a whole arsenal of other tactics to manipulate their parents into being and doing what they want because they think that the source of their own happiness lies with others. Thus, children grow up alternating between what may be called a pharaoh mode and a slave mode type of thinking. There are times when they feel enormously powerful, almost omnipotent, as they exercise their ability to manipulate their parents in order to get what they want. There are other times, though, when they feel inferior and powerless, like resentful slaves forced to submit to oppressive forces beyond their control. That's the slave mentality. In other words, there's two kinds of people in the world. There are masters and there are slaves. And you're either one or the other, or you're vacillating between one and the other. But that's the only way to exist. Either you're dominating or you're being dominated. That is Mitzrayim. That is Mitzrayim. That's how the Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, lived their lives. And that was the kind of culture in their society. You were either one or the other. That's how the Jews lived. And when they came out, that's what they were used to. And Dr. Adahan is saying that to a certain extent, even though we don't live in Egypt, there is that kind of relationship, struggle, that occurs in all people to more or less lesser degree. In order to reach emotional maturity, a child must leave this Mitzrayim mentality. He must learn to look within himself for his sense of worth and joy. It's not someone else's fault. I'm not worth something because somebody said I am, or because somebody gave me something that I like, or because I can manipulate them. I'm not happy because somebody made me happy. It's within myself. And likewise outside of himself, must develop tolerance and respect for his fellow men, not just those at the top or those who agree with him, and must stop using manipulative control tactics to force others to change. Many people, unfortunately, says Dr. Adahan, never make the transition. They remain enslaved in a spiritual Mitzrayim, constantly condemning those who don't measure up, or compulsively seeking approval to make themselves feel loved and successful, while feeling like losers deep inside. They alternate between an angry Pharaoh mode, that is, oppressing others in an attempt to feel superior, and a depressed slave mode, allowing themselves to be oppressed and stifled because they feel helpless, hopeless, and inferior. Now that's all I have room for on this page. So let me pause for a moment and see if anybody has comments to say. Now this is not a classical Torah source. It's written by a psychologist. But I'm intrigued by it. I believe that there is internal messages in Mitzrayim. I believe that in addition to being factual historically, it is also allegorical. And there, we must admit, there is a very great emphasis placed in Jewish tradition about remembering Mitzrayim and mentioning it every single day. And the Talmud says it is something that every person has to imagine themselves as doing daily. So clearly this is not, this bespeaks of an internal, more human, spiritual, emotional reality. Dr. Schultz.
This is my first introduction to this individual.
Yes.
I find that the body of what's presented has a lot of common sense to it. But the introduction is very troubling to me, in which he says that we live with existential threats to the existence of the entire world hanging over our heads. I really don't believe that in any way, shape, or form. We live in a world that is basically a good and safe place,
mm-hmm.
with troubles occurring constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Diseases, tsunamis, earthquakes, fires, so on, but nothing that is existentially threatening our entire existence.
Wow.
So I think she undermines her entire argument when she starts out this way.
Well, thank you, and I want you to know that little excerpt is not part of this essay at all. I chose it. It's on her website. Mm-hmm. Just as a biographical note, so we would get an idea of what she's all about. But that's well taken. It reminds me of something I heard recently. What's the difference between a pessimist and an optimist? The pessimist says, things are so bad, they can't get any worse. The optimist says, oh, yes, they can.
There's another word that is not often used, but
yeah.
I think has a lot of merit. Someone who's an ameliorist. Ameliorist.
That like coats everything?
Yes, that the world, it's what I just expressed.
Yeah.
That the world is a good place, Mm-hmm. And that gets better over time, especially mm-hmm. with man's mm-hmm. endeavors.
Mm-hmm. All right. I like your comment, and I think it really warrants a separate discussion. So rather than comment on it, I'd like to perhaps keep it inside as perhaps a discussion for the future. I think actually that it's very germane to our understanding of Torah externally and internally, and wonderful that you brought it up. Okay. Any other comments?
At the Seder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's pointing me. I lived in Egypt. You know, that was a long time ago.
Right, right.
We can take this out.
Right.
And use it. Of course, there are a lot of kids there.
Right. I mean, whether we choose to read this or not, this forces us to look behind the story. As the Rambam says, don't just read Torah as an allegory. And don't just read Torah as a history book. What is the message? And as the Rambam says, if we don't understand the message of the allegory, he says the allegory itself is meaningless. Hmm. All right. Anybody want to stop here? Or would you like a positive, constructive completion of this essay?
More.
All right. This is an auxiliary page. This is not part of the handout, because the handout's only one page long. Yes, Lenora, please.
Forgive me if I'm...
No questions are out of line.
Thank you. I don't think we have enough of these...
The extra ones?
Here, wait a second. I just want more at the end.
You know what?
Here, I can get a copy.
I only did eight of those.
I can get a copy later.
Okay.
No, I think I have two of them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think one needs to be passed down.
Okay.
That's it. Didn't I give you one?
Yeah.
Just one.
Okay. Yeah, your question.
So my question is, if Pharaoh was worried that in their free time, having too much time would be a problem for the Jews because they would reflect on their spirituality and the meaning of life and then perhaps rise up against him because they might recognize that there's someone more powerful than him.
Very good. Wonderful explanation. Yeah.
But if he knew there was someone more powerful than him and he was afraid of God, why didn't he early on recognize his place under God? Why did Moses have to go 10 times with the plagues saying, you better take heed because God's going to get you? And he kept ignoring him and ignoring him 10 times. Therefore,
are you asking how could there be somebody as insensitive and as anti-spiritual as Pharaoh? How could such a person exist in this world?
I'm saying if he was worried about the Jews finding God
mm-hmm.
and the impact that God could have in their life if they had a lot.
Why didn't he want that impact?
Why didn't he deal with God directly?
In what kind of a way? Would he have taken God on, or would he have embraced God?
I would think he would have realized that he was less than God.
Right. In other words, you're asking, how could a person ever not be spiritual and religious and God-fearing if it's so obvious? I mean, you're asking the ultimate... I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at us. That, in other words, how can a person possibly deny the existence and all mastery of God? The answer is
that Pharaoh is a victim of his society. He lives in Egypt where they don't have spirituality.
But he's all the leader of the society. He could change it.
He is an Egyptian. On the other hand, the gift of the Jews is the value of the individual.
Right.
That's why we're here. We're not Egyptians. We don't believe that the Pharaoh is a Pharaoh and everybody's a slave. Everybody counts. That's the external and internal conflict that we're looking at.
Right.
I have a few questions.
Okay.
I don't know what existential means.
Existential philosophy means you have to find meaningful choices. It's very much hand in hand with humanistic psychology and Maslow, self-actualization, becoming all that you can become. And existential philosophy is this notion based on, like, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, that we each have to find meaning in our lives and make meaningful choices, and it's going to be different for everybody.
In other words, the reality that is... there's only one reality.
But it is a relativist kind of thing that we can each find our own. Sometimes that could imply we can each find our own morality and not believe in some universal Torah truth. So, I mean, sometimes it is at odds with the universal truth.
All of this means, my dear friends, that God and Torah is not easy and it's not natural.
Okay.
And that man was created with the ability to completely deny and completely, it's may call it the ego. Pharaoh, as you said, fancied himself as a god too. To him, the god of the Hebrews was the competition.
Okay.
He could compete with God. He could take God on. And all he was trying to do was keeping his customers away from the competition. Which just goes to show you internally, if we want to understand the Torah and want to understand ourselves, that this is what we are battling against. We have this Pharaoh-like voice inside of us, which is why we experience the slave mentality. So our job in this life, and which is could be a little bit of a response, why you could say that we're under threats existentially, or you could say it's a good world because there's good and there's evil. The evil is very evil. It can undermine everything, and the good can overpower the evil.
Right. So you'd have to define whether the threats are physical or spiritual.
Yes. and they're all of the above. Okay, so all we're doing is we're putting our finger, and I'm sure Wendy has what to say too, but I'd like to finish off Dr. Adahan, and then we'll take further discussion. But I think that's the value of learning Torah internally, is that it starts to really resonate with us, and it starts to get us a little bit excited. Well, that just means that we're not just using our head. We're starting to use our emotions and it's really making a difference. That's good. All right. So continuing from Leaving Egypt by Mary Madahan, Love and Power. This is the positive, resolution of the Egypt conflict. What we choose to love, value, and control determines whether or not we leave Mitzrayim. This transition requires that we, one, recognize that all people deserve love and respect, regardless of their status or accomplishments, by virtue of having been created in God's image. You know that in the Torah Day School, the local day school, Rabbi Rosenbaum, who was the headmaster for 15 years until last year, 2 years ago, he would start every single day on the carpool lineup doing a little routine with the children. And it went, Boker Tov Yeladim, Biladot, good morning, boys and girls, Mashalom Chem Hayom, how are you today? And they would say, Tov Me'od. And then they would all say together, Mashalom Chal Rabbi Rosenbaum, and how are you, Rabbi Rosenbaum? Tov Me'od. Baruch Hashem, thank God. And then they would all say together, we are worthwhile people, because we are created B'Tselem Elokim, because we are created in the image of God. Everything we think, say, and do must show that we are created B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God. That's how some of these children heard that message for 8 or 9 years, 180 days a year. Wow. Imagine the... And And all he's doing is he's quoting a verse in the Torah where it says God created man in his image.
So it becomes incorporated into their being to the extent that they just do it automatically and accept it as is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't, there's still the impulses that are inborn, but it helps. It helps. It would tend, if you have it at such a young age and it's drilled into you that way, you might have a better chance of getting that aspect of the Torah to be more than just intellectual, but to be internal, hopefully. Love and power. Okay, so number two, give up the attempt to control people out of a desire to feel worthwhile or powerful. If our self-worth depends on being able to control others, we are in Mitzrayim. Three, rid ourselves of the winner-loser mentality, which is based on an attachment to things which have no real value and which provide only an illusion of love and power. Our teacher from the yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, used to discourage teachers in schools from using competition to motivate children to learn and do well. He would say, everyone should be rewarded for their accomplishments, not that whoever does the best should be rewarded. That undermines everything we're trying to teach. Those who remain in a spiritual Mitzrayim can never be truly loving because their love is conditional and is restricted to those people who are in complete agreement with them and are exceptionally brilliant, wealthy, or powerful. They can never be truly content because they are constantly running after external signs of love, status, and success. Their view of people is epitomized by a kind of totalitarian mentality expressed in the belief that you deserve to live and be treated with respect only if you come from the right family, have the right looks, and agree with me. Okay, this is pretty, she's pretty strong here. Only by forming lasting bonds of love for God, man, and Torah will one be able to bring oneself out of this darkness. The spiritual journey. The transition from a materialistic value system to a spiritual one is not accomplished without great effort. And unfortunately, we know, for whatever reason, so many of us did not grow up with a Rabbi Rosenbaum drilling this message in. And so we find ourselves caught up in this type of mentality, or, as Rabbi Luzzatto might say, even worse, we might not even realize that we were brought up with these values. We might not think there's anything wrong, which could be even more serious. So how do we make this transition? This is why the concept of spiritual growth is often depicted as a journey in which one is painfully wrenched away from one's old attachments. If we want inspiration to be able to move and change, we don't have to look farther than the story of Abraham. Abraham. Where did he come from? He came from idol worship. For example, when Abraham was commanded to break his ties with his past, God said, "Go away from your country, your kindred, and your father's house to a land that I will show you." Again, we could take this at literal interpretation, and it's just a story about an old bearded man who left his country and traveled to a new land, or we could see ourselves in there. We could say this is an individual who came from some society and was transitioning into another. A spiritual journey requires awareness and separation to become aware of our godly essence. We must separate from all that is false, in particular, our selfish personal desires. When God said, "Go away from your country," country in Hebrew is aretz, which hints at the words ratzah, meaning desire. Go away from your desires. We must also separate from our inborn tendencies to various extremes. Go away from your kindred, in Hebrew is molad, which denotes that which one is born with. And we must also separate, okay, so that would be things that are inborn. We must also separate from the erroneous beliefs which we acquire during our formative years. That would be depicted in our father's house. To leave our childlike view of the world is as difficult and as joyous as the original Exodus. As we develop the wellspring of love, joy, and faith from within ourselves, we free ourselves from our need for status and approval, from our illusory sense of ourselves as winners or failures, from our craving for material possessions, and from the need to control those around us. So, I'm finished. I'd like to listen to what you have to say. Just want to close by saying that if this discussion bothers us a little bit, well, one thing, this is not a classic Torah text, so this is Miriam Adahan. She's a Torah observant person. She's a psychologist. So don't blame her for misrepresenting the sages. She's not a sage. But perhaps, if it is a little bit, makes us feel uncomfortable, perhaps the reason is because we are more comfortable studying Torah on an external level. We are perfectly fine sharing ideas about history and stories and talking about esoteric interpretations of what Abraham said or what Moses said or what went on between Pharaoh and Abraham. But it may make us feel uncomfortable when we start to see the Torah as being personal and as talking to me and perhaps uncovering facts about me as a spiritual being, which I never thought about, and I never thought that I had any problem with that, nor that there was anything particular that I needed to change. And if we're uncomfortable about that, that's good. It's our choice to embrace it, to not let it get us down and feel that we're not valuable. On the contrary, this is what we're here for, to discover our real value as Tzelem Elokim, as the image of God. And we're here for a purpose. The purpose is to discover that about ourselves and to become more and more of who we really are inside. Thank you. Okay. Wendy, let's start with you because I know you had something to say.
All right, so going back to when you were discussing about Caro and his position. So her expression of Mitzrayim as a place of narrowness. So this is the head of this. So we already get an indication that he takes on the greater aspect in being in this place. And, you know, people don't want to be alone. So if he is alone in this position, he can't be validated. He's got to have somebody to validate him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got to make everybody else look like him.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So he's not going to the other side of the fence. So I remember in studying also that Paro, the expression is that he stands on the banks of the river. So if water is likened to Torah, this is also, to me, the person who doesn't see that they need to study Torah. They don't have to delve deep into it. They don't have to use the word transition. We don't have to make any internal changes. Change is scary.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I have. If I venture into something else, the unknown, and I don't know what it's going to do to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
What you said earlier about looking for at the positive or the negative, we don't know, you know, is it going to make me worse? Is it going to make me better? You know, and I've come to realize personally the expression, you shall do and you shall understand, a person, I would never understand and be as grateful and want more if I hadn't have taken those first steps and study and do. The more I put into action, the greater the my appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And it just inspires me to want more and more. So,
Shkoach.
Well,
right on. Right on.
I was thinking of the lecture we heard last night where it's like a busy person can have sleep and someone who's wealthy and has leisure time finds no sleep. And that's what I was thinking of when the quote, he's like, I'll make them work, you know, so that they won't think of anything trivial. And I mean, even though that was what Pharaoh wanted for the Jews, I couldn't help see the connection that, you know, by keeping them busy, that was somehow part of building our character. It actually had the opposite effect. It did exactly what you know, why we were supposed to be in slavery and bondage, so that when we did come out and have the Exodus, it would be much more, it was what was necessary so that we would work hard, but not so much as a slave physically, but work hard spiritually, equally hard, and not think of trivialities like Lashon Hara and mm-hmm. things like that. So I think it kind of backfired in a way, because mm-hmm. that's what Jews do spiritually.
Interesting.
We're slaves to the Torah.
Okay.
And only being a slave to the Torah, Avodah, will set you free.
Beautiful. So what you're saying here is that good and evil, if I can extrapolate on what you're saying, good and evil may in fact be mirror images of each other. The same type of energy that a person puts into evil is actually such a good thing to have that kind of energy. Just let's channel it to the right things. There's a story of a Rav from Europe, you know, in the old days. He was on a train, and it was an overnight train, and he saw there was some guys, they were drinking and they were playing cards, and they were going out into the night. And the rabbi was looking at them, and he started to feel very depressed. And he later explained that he saw the way that they were so fixed on what they were doing, so energized, that they were able to do this into the wee hours of the night without any signs of fatigue. And he says, if only I had that kind of dedication to my studies, I could really learn a lot from them. Now, clearly, he doesn't aspire to be like those people who are putting their energies into that. But what they're doing, and the same thing could be said for Avraham and his father. His father, Terach, was a great man. But he was a great for idol worship. Avraham looked up to his father and emulated his father, but not for the things that his father was using his qualities for. So what you're saying is an interesting thing. What Pharaoh wanted to do, his purpose, his intent, was actually antithetical to spirituality. But some of the exercises that we went through as a Jewish people would later on be used as resources for the acquiring the spirituality, the valuable things that we would need to have.
Yeah, something to that effect.
So it taught us, and the sages do say that the experience of being an eved, being a slave, was actually something we needed to learn, because when we came out of Mitzrayim, God appeared to us, and he says, guess what? Now you're going to be my servants, and I'm going to put you to work. And if we had not had that experience, we may not be in the condition of working. Excellent. Okay. What else?
Which the enthusiasm to have at a football game would be the same thing as the enthusiasm at a show.
Exactly. Exactly.
And your mirror evil of good and made me think of the story of Reish Lakish. Is it Reish Lakish?
Good.
That if he used his energies the right way, you could become the greatest Torah scholar. Very
good. Rabbi Akiva could be the same thing. Rabbi Yochanan, a great sage, saw Reish Lakish, who was the leader of a band of thieves. He saw him in action. And one day he disrobed and he went for a swim in the river. And the rabbi watched this bandit, how his strong strokes and how he would manage those currents. And he looked at him and he says, wow, if you could put that kind of strength to studying of Torah, you would be the greatest. And he right then and there, he proposed to him, if you devote yourself to Torah study, I have a beautiful unmarried sister, I will propose her to marriage with you, and you will become my student. And he grew up to be Rabbi Yochanan, almost Rabbi Yochanan's equal. So the idea of taking those same human qualities and energies that we have, that we may have thought of using them for negative things, we can harness those very same, and we haven't been wasting our time because we've been developing our qualities. Now if we can channel them towards good and Torah, we can be unbelievable.
And the last connection that Rabbi Feldman once said is, it's in the Parsha where it says you should fear God and love God, and it's right after love the convert, because the convert has that emotional connection. Mm-hmm. And like that's supposed to be, that's how you get you use that as a template.
Mm. Wonderful. Yashar Koach, everybody. If you liked it today, come back again next week.
Okay. isn't there what a song? Minamesha Karasi. From
the depth, from the straits. Yes, from the straits.
I heard also one of the reasons they called the triumph Mitter in Arabic is because it's the only country that only has one dimension. No, the Nile.
Uh-huh. 4,000 miles of it, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's 4,000, but it's long.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Very good point. I've heard Rabbi Silverman speak about this, that indeed Egyptian life is centered on the Nile.
Yeah.
And that's where their water comes from. It never rains in Egypt.
Uh-huh.
And therefore Egyptians don't have a habit of looking up to the skies.
It never dries up.
That explains also why Pharaoh would not accept God, because he was in denial.
I stood on the banks of the Nile.
Wow.
Very powerful.
Very powerful. And they worshipped it, I believe. That was they worshipped. Yeah. Very nice. Okay. Have a wonderful Shabbos, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.